Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Welcome to the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast. I'm your host, John Lossoff. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, John Levingood.
You know, yeah, because Mark isn't here today, and this is a really interesting thing to me.
Really?
It occurs to me that, like, I think that Mark is a lot more professional than me.
I mean, it's hard to tell which one of us three is the professional one.
I mean, I think it's easy to identify me as unprofessional in general, but it's different to be specifically professional. And because, like, Mark, like, if I can't make it, like, Mark will be like, look, I wish you could be here. You know, the show's got to go on. People, like, if you have a podcast that you listen to, you know, you expect it every week.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, when Mark is away or something, I usually try and delay. Like, it's like he's like my comfort blanket. My security blanket. Like, I don't want to do it without him, but this time I finally am, and I feel like there's a hole here, and I want to pour some Mark into that hole to fill it.
Well, it's okay, loving good. I'm here to comfort you.
I may not. You're all the way in Florida.
I may not be as warm as Mark, but I'm here.
Not as warm and smushy, and not that he's smushy.
Right, what, right.
Why would a human be smushy?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they need to get on a treadmill more often. Okay. Yeah, Mark is probably somewhere like... he's probably got like two hipsters in a headlock somewhere. That's what he does in his off time.
You know, most of the time I'm away, he's making fun of like me eating my way through the nation.
Well, this is your chance.
But like, you know what? No, so it's like... Well, you know how we're all different on Facebook, right? Our behaviors. So, like, if I go on a trip, I'm posting by the minute what is happening on my trip, including, as Mark once quoted, this didn't really happen, but a double brisket pizza at 9 in the morning.
That sounds really like, good.
But, like, Mark, it's not until he gets back from a trip, and then he puts all the pictures from the trip, not until he's back home. So you don't know what he's doing. Like, he could be on a CIA mission, and this is like a cover-up. This is like the CIA, right? Because, like, when I'm on a trip, you know where I am. You can check on me. When Mark's on a trip, it's almost like when Arnold Schwarzenegger would get home in True Lies and he'd have a couple fake postcards in a snow globe. Mm-hmm. You just hand him everything at the end of the trip.
Wait, so you're saying Mark's actually a CIA agent?
He could be. He's in really good shape, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's in his mid-30s and he's married for years now, a few years now, right? And he stays very thin. He's a big guy. He's a tall, big guy. Mm-hmm. He's got intimidating arms that look like legs.
Yeah.
Right? Like, maybe he's pulling a Mr. Smith. Like, that Brad Pitt contractor should not have been built like that.
I see.
If he was really contracting. Well, not contract killing, though. I guess that's the irony in him being a contractor in that movie.
So you're saying his marriage is actually a cover-up?
You know, it could be, because I've seen Megan box the crap out of his arm. He'll, like, have to beg her to... Like, she's
also a CIA operative.
They're both fighters. And Mark would box his brother when he was younger. That's a fighting household. And then he comes back and gives Facebook all this stuff, so we think that he was in Chicago when really he was, like, in Prague slitting some dignitary's throat.
Right. Hey, Prague's lovely this time of year. All right. Let's move on before Mark actually he decides to slit our throats.
Dude, if he's saying too much. He's probably listening in somehow right now.
Yeah. Yeah. He's listening live right now.
Like, my house is bugged.
Yeah. Well, literally, you got bugs all over your place. Heyo, inside joke. All right, Levingood, I think it's time to start the podcast like we usually do with listener questions.
Sure. Frequent questioner Neil from Greenville asks, Do you guys think that Ghost Dad can roofie drinks?
Wow. Neil just went right for it, didn't he?
Yeah, he really did. You know, he came up with this when I told him we were going to do Ghostbusters, but then I had to reveal that we save up the listener questions and do them in the order we receive them. And he said, I still want to know.
Yeah.
So okay. Ghost Dad came out in 1990 for our young viewers and starred Bill Cosby.
Who? What is Bill Cosby known for these days?
Pretty much just roofing people, I guess. Because
also Jell-O pudding pops.
I feel like every week, more people come forward and join this mass set of claims of like sexual harassment or assault against him.
Yeah,
it's, or against them by him, right?
Yeah.
It's got to be inflated. I'm not saying that he didn't do these things, but you know how like people, like everyone, I think some people might be jumping in, but it's a lot. I think it's like 90 people now.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely, you know, a really massive downfall for such a,
well,
you know,
hold on. If Mark was here, he'd say allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly a massive downfall.
He allegedly did these things.
Because Bill Cosby was known to be, you know, the upright, you know, authoritarian fodder figure. And it's just all these allegations coming out. It's just really, man, it really puts in a light all those old Cosby show episodes.
It's also interesting because, like, I don't remember if we talked about this in the podcast or not before, but he bought up the rights to the old Amos and Andy material.
Oh, really?
So that they couldn't re-release it on DVD. And Blu-ray it subsequently in the future. So he bought it up to kind of eliminate it from history over time because it is now, well, and then, very racist.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was, like, at the time, considered a champion of African-American rights, of black rights. It's interesting that, you know, there's that end, and then now all this unfortunate ugliness is coming up.
Right.
But I guess the question is not really about Bill Cosby. It's about a fictitious character, Ghost Dad.
Yeah. How much a Ghost Dad is really Bill Cosby in real life?
You know, he seemed to be exactly that character. I don't even think he acted.
So, Ghost Dad, we're going to make some assumptions here. Obviously, he's played by Bill Cosby. He maybe has the same vices that real-life Bill Cosby had. He liked to roofie.
Allegedly
roofie some people. So how would a ghost get his hands on a roofie?
So literally? I was thinking about that, right? So I figure the same exact year the movie Ghost with Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze came out,
mm-hmm.
and the subway ghost, Vincent Schiavelli, the Sicilian guy, the really tall Sicilian guy with the baggy eyes.
Yeah.
He, the guy who's like, get off my train. He knew how to affect the material, the corporeal world, right? And he taught Patrick Swayze how to manipulate physical objects because ghosts in that universe couldn't manipulate physical objects. I think something similar happened in Ghost Dad, too. I think at first he was trying to signal his family to let him know that he was overseeing them or almost like as if he was in denial of being dead. And then later I think that he was able to get him some signals, some nice loving signals to know that he was watching over them.
So how would he signal someone to take a roofie?
Well, no, you don't. You don't. You get that Sicilian ghost in the New York subway to teach you how to manipulate matter. So what you do is, like, you use that power that they had. It had the sound like, right, when he would move something.
Yeah.
And to pop that roofie into the drink.
I see.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
I think that's the answer.
I think,
right?
We just,
I mean, what do you think?
I think we're describing like one of the deleted scenes from Ghost Dad. Bill Cosby paid to have it taken out of a movie.
Back when it was rated PG-13 instead of PG. He was straight up like just slipping Mickeys and drinks.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, let's go with that as the final answer. Man. Bill
Vincent
Cosby.
Schiavelli.
Bill Cosby questions, man. They're tough. They're tough.
Is that our first ever in the history of movies, films, and flicks? Is that our first Bill Cosby question?
Yeah.
It's like a milestone.
It probably won't be the last either.
71 episodes to get to a Bill Cosby question.
Sure. Not bad. All right. What's our next listener question?
All right, so this next listener question is a doozy. Like, it's a big, very, 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 very specific question. But I think that the questioner included so much information in the question that you don't need to have seen the movie to produce an answer. So, in the Josie from Las Vegas asks, in the movie Frankenhooker, I get how the genius electrician guy managed to bring his dead girlfriend back to life. He has an electrical background, and he's obviously a genius. But when he himself dies, how does his revived girlfriend manage to figure out how to bring him back to life using just his plans and drawings? She was just a regular person when they were dating, and she's since been fused with a bunch of hookers. So how does any of that make sense, that she would suddenly be able to read electrical drawings so complex that they could regenerate life?
You know, I have actually never seen Frankenhooker.
You haven't seen that classic?
I know, shocking. So, but I know you have.
Oh, I love the movie. I've reviewed it on our website.
So I think I'll take you, I'll let you take the lead on this question.
Okay, so, yeah. Well, first off, what's interesting is that the director is Frank, it's like Frank Hellenhotter.
Oh, okay.
But there's a weird, I don't know, for some reason that makes me think of Frankenstein and Frankenhooker. Frank Hellenhotter, Frankenhooker, I don't know, am I nuts? Seems similar. But, so okay, in this movie, right, I think that the character, Frankenhooker, used the chopped up hooker spare parts, right? I mean, she used them, we know that, because her boyfriend, when she revives him, has boobs. So older campy horror movies just kind of did what they felt like, all right? And this isn't exclusive to old horror movies. Bloodsport. Lazavath, you've seen Bloodsport.
Yes.
Right? We've all seen Bloodsport like 80 times, right? So in Bloodsport, they do what Mark would call yada-yadaing things, where they just need something to happen and they just make it happen. Well, like, you know, so it's not just cheap horror. And in Bloodsport, there's this secret kumite, right? In the very beginning, we know it's a secret kumite, but when we see Van Damme, like, spin-kicking a speed bag in a gym, this guy comes up to him. He's like, Captain Van Damme, the colonel heard that you were going to the Kumite and he wants to talk to you. And I'm just thinking, how did he know this? And then later when Van Damme is playing video games, remember in the hotel lobby in Hong Kong and he meets Donald Gibbs, Ray Jackson?
Yeah.
Well, they're playing the game and after Van Damme beats him in the game, he says, you want to see some real fighting? You should come see me fight in the Kumite. So like people are talking very liberally about this thing, but it's this big secret. And it's a secret competition in China where the prize is a Japanese iconic sword, a katana. Like, there's so much stuff in this movie that just... So, like, I think that Frankenhooker is really just pulling a Van Damme Bloodsport. Like, when they're just like, oh, and wouldn't it be great if he came back with boobs from hooker parts? And the guy's like, yeah. They say, how does he do it? I don't know. The girlfriend just does it.
You know, Living Good, I think it's safe to assume that you're the first person in history to link Frankenhooker and Bloodsport.
Dude, okay, wait, hold on. So when Frank Dukes, right, is talking to his master about going there, he said he wanted to go to honor him because the master's son died, right? And so they never say how the son died. Did Frank kill him?
Does it matter at that point?
I don't know, but they don't explain it. And then remember when he shows up? And they don't believe that guy is his master, and they say, you got to show me the Dimak.
Yeah.
Okay, remember how they had the bricks just set up?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they believed Frank, then there would have been no reason to do the Dimak. But the bricks were already set up. So does that mean that they had that set up just in the off chance that some random guy representing this school of training wasn't who they thought he was? Because otherwise, people would have just been walking by a pile of bricks.
What's wrong with always being prepared?
I'm just saying, like movies just... Sometimes these old movies, they just do whatever the hell they feel like.
I wish more movies did that these days.
Okay, well, so now I want to know your take on Frankenhooker about how a stitchwork horror of severed hooker parts could reanimate her boyfriend with severed hooker parts.
Okay. I'm thinking maybe that one of the parts that she was kind of stitched up with, like maybe that hooker was like an electrical engineer before she became a hooker.
Back when she lived in the Czech Republic.
Yeah, yeah.
And they wouldn't honor her degree here.
Yeah, yeah. So then she started, selling herself on the streets. And then, like, you know, she died from drugs and, like, also all that stuff. And then, like, you know, that knowledge that she, that Czech electrical engineering knowledge got transferred to her in the Frankenhooker. And she used that to bring the dude back to life.
I think that sounds plausible.
It's a pretty good theory, I think, for someone who's never watched the movie, Frankenhooker. Is that on Netflix? It's probably not, right?
So, Eastern European prostitute electrical engineers and the Dimmock.
Yes. What else could it be? All right, yeah. Good listener questions. Bill Cosby, Bloodsport, and Frankenhooker.
You're already slurring your speech, Laz.
Yeah.
Did you get a drink and not leave your hand over the top of it? Because I think a ghost dad might have. Yeah. Whispered, you're already slurring your speech.
Do you see like a corporeal like Bill Cosby over my shoulder?
Doing this like Jell-O pudding face.
Okay. Thank you for those wonderful listener questions. Sorry we disappointed you, but that's okay. At least we entertained you. I'm 100% sure we did.
Hey, listeners, you're welcome for correlating Frankenhooker to Bloodsport.
Yeah. They're expecting you to make, like, a diagram.
I could.
Yeah.
Could totally make a flowchart.
Yeah. Okay, so on to the topic of the day. I think... Oh, yeah, so the topic's on me today. So I'm used to throwing a topic to either you or Mark. It's like, it's really weird. I'm like, no, I gotta take the ball. I'm like, what do I do with it?
Just start rambling about the movie.
Okay. Actually, so today we're going to talk about Star Trek and the new movie that's come out, Star Trek Beyond. But I want to take it back a little bit to the year 2002, the last movie that starred the cast of Next Generation. You know, up until this point, the Star Trek franchise was like huge. It was a huge franchise. People
was that the movie Star Trek Generations?
No, there were a couple movies after Generations, but Nemesis was the last one starring the Next Generation cast.
Did that have Tom Hardy as the bad guy?
Yes, Tom Hardy played the quote-unquote clone of Picard. Okay. So Star Trek Nemesis came out. It got abysmal critical reviews. It did poorly at the box office. It was around this time, Star Trek Enterprise was also on TV, and Enterprise was also getting terrible reviews and terrible ratings. And the general feeling was that, you know, people were starting to get burnt out from Star Trek. And
is that the one with Scott Bakula?
Yeah.
As the captain?
I mean, it kind of got better in the second season, but that didn't save it from cancellation. But yeah, the general feeling, even among hardcore Star Trek fans, that, like, you know, it's just Star Trek's kind of lost. Like, people are getting burnt out. Like, it didn't seem like the writers knew what they were doing. And, you know, we didn't have any new Star Trek movies or TV shows until J.J. Abrams made a reboot in 2009 called, appropriately, Star Trek.
which in a way, is a combination of Star Trek 6 original cast.
Yeah.
Or after Star Trek Generations original and Next Generation cast / reboot.
Yeah, it was a reboot, but done in a very Star Trek style.
Well, but it was a reboot, but you had Spock.
Leonard Nimoy Spock, yeah.
Played by the original Spock, playing his original character, whose entire history was time-space continuum warped.
Yeah.
So really,
it was genius. Yeah. Go ahead.
Continuation.
It was just it was genius because they basically just like rebooted the franchise to tell new stories, but at the same time they still honored the past movies. Like they didn't just dismiss them. Like it's still part of the timeline. It's so very Star Trek. You have like, you know, parallel timelines now, and it's just like, oh, it was such a great like reward for like Star Trek fans, because like, you know, they're very kind of, Star Trek is more hardcore sci-fi than Star Wars. I know like that's not like a really high bar. Like Star Wars is more action oriented, but like, you know, Star Trek's always got like it's always carried like a cache of like really deep sci-fi stories. So having like a reboot done in that style was it felt really rewarding as a Star Trek fan. So
yeah, I agree with that too. I think that the fans, don't get me wrong, fans of like any major label or brand get very apprehensive about reboots or reimaginings or sometimes sequels for the sake of sequels. And I remember when I saw Star Trek, so I was not a Voyager fan, a Deep Space Nine fan. And by that, I might have seen three episodes of Deep Space Nine, none of Voyager, none of Enterprise.
Yeah.
But I saw probably all the episodes of The Next Generation back when it was new. And I've probably seen every episode of the original series at least twice, with my cousin Ryan and my uncle Rick, because he owned them all. We just go through them. Our favorite was the Doomsday Machine. So I love the older Star Trek storylines before things fizzled out.
So when you first heard that they were rebooting Star Trek and they were using the characters from the original series, what was your reaction?
So I was actually very excited. But bear in mind, the fact that I was completely disconnected from three different Star Trek series. Again, you know, what was it? Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise. Yeah. I did not get those subsequent drops in quality. And I'm not saying they're bad because I haven't seen them. But it's like people say actually a lot of good things about Deep Space Nine for the stories. But in general, like those aren't regarded the same as the first two series.
Right.
And so I didn't get those kind of, it's almost like a sequel disappointment. I didn't get those. So for me, it was more like, I haven't seen any new Star Trek in forever. And by the way, like even the original Star Trek movies, mm-hmm. I think I saw all of them, but probably haven't seen any of them since the 90s. And then the Next Generation cast Star Trek movies, I might have seen one here or there on HBO or cable, but I didn't see them all and I didn't see them in order. So yet furthering my disconnect, you know. So for me, and J.J. Abrams, for God's sake, like for me, I was just nothing but excited. I hadn't been browbeaten by all these attempts to reinvigorate Star Trekiness, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a great cast. I really love Chris Pine from Bottle Shock, actually, was my favorite movie of his at the time. Had a big, ambitious cast. Great effects.
John Cho and Simon Pegg.
Dude, and they nailed it, though.
Yeah.
But I will say, in the first reboot Star Trek movie, his accent was distinctly, not Cho, Simon Pegg's Scottish accent was a little more amplified than it was in Star Trek Into Darkness and Star Trek Beyond.
I think the only cast member that I feel like didn't really nail it, and like I'm going to get like a lot of disagreements on this, but Zachary Quinto as Spock.
So I think he did a good job, but I know exactly what you mean.
So it's not because Zachary Quinto did a bad job. I thought he does a really good job as Spock. It's just Leonard Nimoy, he really embodied that role. Like, he really breathed life into that role. It was just, it's hard to live up to that.
Well,
you know,
there's one thing that's.
Well, plus you had Leonard Nimoy in the movie playing a Spock as well. So it's just like, you can't avoid the comparisons, even in the movie.
Yeah, you know? I was very pleased with Zachary Quinto's performance, mm-hmm. but I can't help but to feel what you felt. But is it, do you think that it's actually a deficit on the part of Zachary Quinto's performance, or instead a reflection of how everyone else exceeded expectations. If you just looked at him, did he really disappoint?
No.
Or is it just a relative disappointment?
He didn't disappoint. It's just Leonard Nimoy has like a certain gravitas.
Oh, his presence.
Like,
about him.
Like, yeah. It's just Zachary Quinto, you know, God bless him, he doesn't have that. A lot of actors don't, you know. That's nothing to be ashamed of. So it's just, I think he did an admirable job. It's just he just doesn't live up to Leonard Nimoy, which isn't anything to be ashamed about at all.
So on that same note, right, we see young Kirk.
Yes.
And Chris Pine. And we see him rebellious, and we see him... He's basically rebellious the whole time, up until parts of the last act. But he's kind of rebellious continuously. He just got slightly less rebellious.
Yeah.
So do you feel that he properly lived up to the role?
I'm also going to get a lot of disagreements about this, but I think Chris Pine actually does a better job than William Shatner did. Yeah.
Okay, you know what's funny is that I kind of want to agree with you, but the thing is that Zachary Quinto was not Zachary Quinto. They wrote that our new Spock like the old Spock, but younger and discovering himself. You could almost imagine that back then, but you would never have imagined that this would be young Kirk.
Yeah.
20 years ago. You never would have imagined that. So I think it's because they went a totally different direction with Kirk, right? The flagship leader.
Yes.
And whereas, you know, but Scotty was just like Scotty, but just with a fun contemporary character, that an actor that we know. You know, the same thing with Zulu, the same thing with Mr. Chekhov.
Uhura.
Uhura?
Yeah.
We never learned her first name, I don't think.
I mean, you can Google it.
No, I mean, in the new series, did she ever say it? Because that was a thing in the new Star Trek Part One.
Yeah,
Kirk would say, "Uhura, what's your first name?" And then she just like kind of like she was always pissed at him for some reason, so she wouldn't tell him. when he became captain, remember when he was all beaten up by Spock?
Yeah,
he should have been like, "Uhura, I order you to tell me your first name. Get me your personnel file. Get me HR.
She's like, "No, I didn't tell you anything."
That's right. That first movie, right? That movie was introducing us to the military nature of these explorers, right? It's like military meets Peace Corps, I guess, right? And all the other Star Trek dogma that I'm aware of, they skip right into, hey, we've all been doing this a while.
Right. Well, I think this is kind of in the early years of the Federation. So there's still like a little bit of an uneasiness, like when they're going out exploring. You know, when we get to like the later like parts of the timeline, like the Federation has already been like, you know, essentially established. So like there's peace everywhere. But it's still kind of Wild West in this era. So, but...
Like Wild Beastie Boys sabotage West.
Yeah. But no, I love, you know, the reboot. It kind of hit like all the right emotional beats for me as far as the James T. Kirk character. You know, you had like a clear motivation for why he wanted to join Starfleet. He wanted to live up to his heroic father, played by the heroic Chris Hemsworth.
And what a great opening sequence that was, by the way.
Yes, yes.
If you're going to have a bit role, I mean, well, it's not like a total bit. I think he had like, he might have had 6 minutes of screen time. It's not like some 30-second cameo. But like that role, that was powerful. And then when Bruce Greenwood, Captain Pike?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when Bruce Greenwood is trying to recruit Kirk, right, in that bar after the fight, and he's saying, you know, it's like your father was a captain for 8 minutes and he saved over 250 lives. I dare you to do better. Like so it wasn't just a great opening scene, but 15 minutes later, you kind of relived those tingles. If you were affected by the opening sequence, you were affected powerfully by that line. It's not like a one-trick pony with a good opener.
Yeah, it's such a great, like, new, fresh insight into the James T. Kirk character. Because anybody who's ever watched the original show, like, you know, he never really played by the book. He's always kind of just, like, shot from the hip sometimes. But he's also still, you know, charismatic and roguish. And, you know, the new movie just kind of played off of those themes. You know, it kind of explored, like, why he is the way he is. And it also, you know, developed, like, the beginnings of his friendship with Spock and how there was a very, very heated rivalry between those two.
You know, what's interesting is that seeing Spock kind of discover, if you will, or not discover, but learn to accept instead of viciously refute emotional response.
Yes.
As he learned to accept it, it actually made me think of Next Generation and how very gradually, one of the best parts about Star Trek Next Generation to me was how patient they were with the emotional evolution of Data.
Oh, yes.
Right? Because he went from total automaton, you know, to, I don't understand your world, explain to me. Okay, now I'm starting to learn about your world. Oh, what is this feeling? Oh, it appears that you're feeling this. Like, it's like an autistic spectrum thing. And it wasn't until, like, season 3, I want to say, that they gave him a basic emotion chip. It wasn't until 4 or 5, and now I'm totally speaking arbitrarily, it was just later that he was making amazing self-derived emotional decisions like self-sacrifice. So, I mean, they really took their time. And, of course, you can't do that in a 90-minute, or that is more like a 2-hour-and-15-minute movie. It's a J.J. Abrams movie. Mm. But you can't do that in all that time. And for the little bit of time they had, yeah, I thought they did a good job showing us some of the emotional evolution of Spock.
Right.
It was challenging playing the double Spock because, like you said, you have the gravitas of original Spock, and then you have, not newcomer to the screen or anything, but still, you have first-time Spock, Zachary Quinto, and, you know, a new writer to the Star Trek stories, trying to, in the span of a movie, right, give you the same kind of development. That's challenging. So it's a little harder to make that big impact like Kirk,
right,
like Chris Pine did with Kirk, I think. It was a big challenge. I'd say they both accomplished the same impact, they have the same level of accomplishment. It just happened to be regarded with different impacts.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say in a roundabout way.
But, I mean, overall, the movie did very, very well at the box office. 95% currently on Rotten Tomatoes. I'd say that's pretty good.
I loved it, man. You know what was interesting is how
You got to mention Carl Urban as Bones.
Oh, he's great as Bones, isn't he?
He's great in all the movies.
You know what's funny is that he's like the only character where, I mean, I guess you see his development sort of.
Yeah.
He kind of just gets dropped in the same way Scotty does. Like, he just is.
Yeah.
Like, he's anxious about flying. He's anxious about launches. He's anxious about being transported. He's anxious about going on the surface of planets on missions in all the movies, right?
Yes.
And he's always, in a way, more logical than Spock.
I don't want to say he's the comic relief, because he's not. He's more like the security blanket. He's the Mark Hoffmeyer.
He's the straight guy, the guy playing it straight.
He's the guy that you can count on to say those classic lines that you know and love, basically. So, but no, Carl Urban's great. The movie, like, it was a fantastic reboot. I just can't think of a better way to reboot a franchise like that.
They did a great job. If I had a gripe, it would be the monsters on the ice planet.
Oh, yeah. It was very Star Wars-like.
Right? It basically looked like the Cloverfield monster tried to eat a rabid wampa. Because remember, first Chris Pine was chased down by that weird quadruped evil wampa thing, and then that weird queen alien Cloverfield monster came out and chased it, and then him. But, you know, totally random. But that was kind of like that weird monster in the Star Trek, or in the Star Wars Episode 7,
yeah,
on the Millennium. You know, it's like it was just random that Han Solo was transporting it. They were just trying to give us a weird monster for fun. And one thing I thought was neat was that they gave us a strong callback in the first Star Trek reboot movie to the Wrath of Khan when they captured Captain Pike, Bruce Greenwood. Mm-hmm. And he said, like, this is a Chundathan slug. It was a something or other slug. But that creature was kind of like the equivalent of the Seti eels from Wrath of Khan.
Right.
That would burrow into your brain. In this case, he's like, it'll, you know, cling to your brain stem and soon you'll tell me whatever I want. But it was the same. They gave a neat little callback to it. And then they were going to put that thing down poor Bruce Greenwood's throat.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Wrath of Khan. Let's move on. Anyway, so Star Trek Into Darkness. It comes out in 2013. So Into Darkness was interesting because there was, I guess, like the big marketing ploy for the movie was they kind of hid the fact that Benedict Cumberbatch was playing Khan, right?
Wait, now, did they actually say it out loud in the movie?
I don't think
they said it out loud.
Oh, no, I think they do, actually. I mean, I'll be honest here. I've only seen the movie, like, twice? And it's been, like, a year since I've seen it. So Into Darkness came out, and it was a good movie, but for some reason, it didn't really hit home for me.
So yeah. I thought it was a very good action movie. It was a good summer blockbuster popcorn movie, but it was not an emotionally powerful movie like the first or third.
Right.
And it was not, in my opinion, a powerful Star Trek contribution. But let's say what it wasn't, okay? What else it wasn't? It was not a disappointing sequel. It may not have been as great as the first Star Trek reboot, but it's not like, what was it? Like this, that Pirates of the Caribbean movie part two was really, like, that was a total mess just to set up part three. That happens to a lot of sequels. This didn't do that. It did its own thing. It was a very different style, right, than mm-hmm. the first one.
Sure.
Very different style.
Yeah.
And I liked what they were doing. If it disappointed me, it was only relative to how part one affected me. What's your take?
I think, the main reason why this movie felt very disappointing to me, and it may seem kind of shallow, but so the first movie, I mean, overall, it was a very good movie, but it also made me really excited because it ended with them, like, saying, like, you know, we're about to go on a 5-year mission of, like, going to all these adventures and whatnot. And the second movie, like, they still haven't really started their 5-year mission yet. They're still just kind of hanging around, you know, Starfleet, around Earth. I'm just like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm still waiting for you guys to take off, like, and explore, but you know, you're still hanging around. You know, it felt very kind of disappointing.
Yeah. You know, one thing I did like, though, is that, so we see all these characters develop in part one, right? Or even if they get dropped in like Scotty or Chekhov, basically as they always are, we still see them kind of nestle themselves comfortably into the new Star Trek reboot in the first movie. Whereas once we get to the second movie, everyone does feel comfortably lived in. They're all very credible in their roles. They don't need to prove anything new to us anymore. Right. They all accomplished that in part one, and they accomplished convincing us that they have continued to be that. And sometimes, you know, they give new character arcs in sequels that really can backfire on character impact. And I don't think there was any of that in this. If there was any, it was just because of all the deliberation between Enterprise members about the Khan character. That was a little belabored to me.
Yes. I will say Benedict Cumberbatch really did an excellent job. Like, he was a very, very menacing character. He has that voice, you know.
But he has a great voice, right? He's good. He is a chameleon of physical presence, because when you compare his Sherlock character to, like, this, to him in the Imagination Game, and then, of course, even though it was CGI, still, like, the presence conveyed through Smaug, like, he can do it all.
Yes.
He can do demure and unimposing outside of the intellectual side. He always has to be intellectual. That's the caveat. Mm-hmm. But he's very powerful. I think he's an exquisite actor. I'm excited to see him in Doctor Strange.
Yes. I also enjoyed Alice Eve in this movie for that gratuitous, gratuitous like lingerie shot. Turn around.
In part one we had the green girl, so in part two, you know, we got to keep. It's about equal opportunity. So now we're going to go with a human.
Right. You know, I will say, like, even though I'm kind of ragging on it, like, I was disappointed by it, but I was also entertained by Into Darkness. Like, it wasn't a bad follow-up. It just wasn't the follow-up I wanted, if that makes any sense.
So Khan is, like, pretty much our bad guy in the first half of the movie.
Right?
Well, he was a great bad guy as the bad guy in the first half of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to the first movie, Eric Bana and Clifton Collins Jr. as these, you didn't even know who the actors were. You couldn't even tell by their voices unless you had a hint beforehand. I didn't know after I saw the movie that it was those guys. Now I watch it and I can recognize them. I can pick them out. But I did not really, I liked their mission. I was convinced by their mission. I honestly wasn't convinced by their characters. The first movie, the bad guys in the first movie. I never doubted Khan, even though he was duplicitous. You know, like his, you always bought what he was dealing.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't buy what Bana was dealing. Sorry, Eric Bana.
Yeah.
Didn't like you in Deliver Us from Evil either. Episode 4. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm still mad at you for Incredible Hulk.
was that his fault?
It was like half his fault, half Ang Lee's fault.
I think it was just Ang Lee's fault. In that one, I'm going to give it to Bana.
Right.
I'm going to give it to Bana. But, you know, so the way that part two ends, mm-hmm. Just because of all the Khan talk, it's just on my mind. Did you not expect Khan to return in part three with a greater scale vengeance to be what I would call the real Wrath of Khan movie in the reboot?
Yeah, they definitely left it open and ambiguous for his return because they didn't kill him off. They just left him in, what, the cryostasis with the rest of his people.
Like, right? It was almost like it was obvious that this is going to be our next movie. We're going to see him again. We're going to be calling him Khan through the whole movie instead of, like, that's Khan. No, it's like everyone will be saying it in the dialogue. That's what I thought was going to happen.
I mean, I would love to see Benedict Cumberbatch again, but at the same time, I didn't. Like, I just wanted, in my head, I was going, like, oh, let's just see him, like, go off and explore, like, new planets and new aliens, you know, things like that. So at the end of Into Darkness, when they actually go out on and start their 5-year mission, I'm like, oh, thank you. It felt like we did this, like, you know, already in 2009, but sure. You know,
so another thing that I liked, by the way, you know, so this is a like and an unlike. When you see something that you love, you almost wish that they made all the movies together. So that, like, every year, every 2 years, you get a movie, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with this, it was 4 years between part one and part two, right?
Hold on. Yeah, I think so.
2009 and 2013?
Yeah.
So, like, they didn't rush it, and as a result, I mean, maybe that helped with being more patience with the writing. I don't know if that was their original release schedule, but it's kind of a relief when you see someone take their time instead of saying, oh, all right, this worked, this made money, so in 6 months after this hits theaters, we're going to start filming the next movie, which will be released in 2 years from the time of the release. You know, it's like they really push the envelope so hard to break records with money that they don't care all the time about the story. And at least part two held together.
Right.
Very well, in fact. I don't mean that as a minimalist, like it barely, it was very, I liked it a lot. I own part one and two.
All right. Well, I think now's a good time to take a break. I'm going to go watch Star Trek IV Is that the one where they have to go back in time and save the whales? Right?
Is that 4 or 5?
It was like one of them. Well, we'll find out. We'll be right back.
Hey, podcast fans. I'm Jonathan, and I'm here to talk to you about an exciting new podcast called Top 5. It's brought to you by Shark Dropper. Can you think of anything and everything that you wanted counted down, anywhere from shitty cereals to worst bands ever to top 5 athletes, maybe even the top 5 movies? Well, guess what? We counted down from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 to 6. No, I'm just kidding. We counted down to 1 every time, every week. Shark Dropper Studios, sharkdropper.com.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I actually just got a communique from Mark. I guess he found out we were talking about his covert CIA activities.
It's like, get the recording.
Stop. Stop. Yeah. He just wanted to set the record straight. It wasn't Prague. It was Berlin. Sorry.
Dude, you can't trust whatever he's saying. If he says it's Berlin, you know it's not Berlin.
Yeah, it's probably Tennessee or something.
He just said Berlin because some other terrorist killed some other guy there.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, yeah, that was me. That way you won't know what I really did.
That Mark's a tricky one, man. He says it in one place, but he's really in another. You don't really know what that guy.
Dude, he's like Robert Redford from Spy Game and Civil War. Or not Civil War, the Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
That's the same character. I maintain that Spy Game is in the same cinematic universe as the Marvel Universe, and that's the same character.
I'm down with it. All right. I think we have one more listener question.
Right? One more, yeah. And this third question comes from horror podcaster extraordinaire Billy Crash from the Last Knock podcast on iTunes. Billy asks, if you could be on set for the making of any film, what would it be?
So, okay. First thing that comes to mind is any Adam Sandler movie. And the reason why is because if I'm on a set of an Adam Sandler movie, that means I'm on the Adam Sandler gravy train. Like, I'm being taken care of, all right? Like, I don't have to worry about, you know, paying for my kids' college or, like, or my mortgage. Like, Adam Sandler's got me covered.
Like, if you're in one of his movies, you're going to be in 16 of his movies.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm set. So I would love to be on a set of an Adam Sandler movie because I know, like, I just hit the jackpot. But so I guess my serious answer would be probably Apocalypse Now. It's kind of legendary for all the terrible things that happened on set, you know, while they were trying to make it. You know, you had Martin Sheen basically just, you know, have like a on-set breakdown. You had like all the troubles in the jungle. It was just, it's legendary. They even made like a documentary in the book about it, about how terrible it was to make that movie. So, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Look it up.
So, like, I've got all sorts of answers for different reasons, right?
All right.
In fact, I think we had a listener question that had Lazabeth produce a similar answer. Like, I'd like to be on the set of Showgirls or maybe Striptease. For obvious reasons.
Right.
Maybe Fast and Furious 8 movie just to see what really happened with that drama between Vin and The Rock. Maybe The Wolverine just to watch Hugh Jackman like constantly starving and doing sets of like, you know, dumbbell military press between takes to keep his veins popping and then like housing chicken breasts. But for me, my number one choice would be Conan the Destroyer.
Really?
Because Conan the Destroyer had Andre the Giant, Wilt Chamberlain, and Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, among other people, of course, as well. But like, so Arnold Schwarzenegger, right, when he wasn't in competition shape, back when he was making this movie, so he's 6'2", and he weighed like 245-ish, right? Mm-hmm. With abs and a pretty small waist in this movie. He's a huge guy. He can probably bench press, I don't know, if he really tried. He's not a power lifter, but I'm sure he could bench like 600 pounds. Yeah. I've seen footage of him repping 400 when he would only weigh 220. So like, he's a really strong guy, right? Wilt Chamberlain picked him up like with his hands under his armpits and moved him.
Really?
As a demonstrate. But you see, Wilt Chamberlain, it was considered one of the greatest feats of physical strength ever when Wilt Chamberlain bench pressed 300 pounds. Because even though loads of people have bench pressed 300 pounds, Wilt Chamberlain's arms are so long that it takes more physical work to move that weight because it's a greater distance.
Yeah, he has to go twice as far as everybody.
And the other thing is that it's disproportionately harder on the limbs. So that was a huge feat. No one blinked an eye when Arnold Schwarzenegger is doing sets of 8 or 12 on 400 on bench press. Everyone was really impressed when Wilt Chamberlain did 300. Wilt Chamberlain's like, he's like 6'8" and has those and has big pecs. That didn't exist back then. Basketball players did not work out back then.
Yeah.
Like they do now. You know, like deltoids like LeBron's did not exist in the 70s and 80s. So, like, that was unusual, right? And then you have Andre the Giant, who, again, like, he could just pick up and throw Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was just, it's just interesting to me as a weightlifter because I've heard this account from Arnold in interviews when he'd talk about being on the set, how he would insist on paying for dinner, like when they would be when they would eat out. But of course, he was new; he wasn't rich yet. He was wealthy to us, but he wasn't movie star rich.
Right.
Andre the Giant, he was wrestling rich. Wilt Chamberlain, he was basketball rich. So they got upset when Arnold would take the tab because they thought it was like, you know, just all about his arrogance or something. And at one point, I heard the story that, like, Andre the Giant literally picked him up and moved him out of his way to walk past him because he was pissed off that Arnold picked up the check.
Wow.
Because Arnold got up and walked over to the waiter and paid the waiter, like, when he said he was going to the restroom, which is a trick that I use on people who are hosting me. But still, like, he did that because it was always – they were always insisting because they knew that they were superstar rich and they knew that Arnold wasn't yet. And so, like, but that's just, it's seeing that kind of interesting dynamic that has nothing to do with the movie. And all these guys got along really well, from what I understand, offset.
So you just wanted to see Arnold get picked up like a little rag doll.
Because you know what? It's a reality statement is what, you know what? It just brings to light that often bigger simply does imply stronger.
Right.
It's just, people look at, what do you bench is how strong you are. Well, Wilt Chamberlain can only bench 300 pounds. But guess what? His pecs are actually stronger than Schwarzenegger's, probably. And overall, he's stronger. So it's just, it's one of those weird dynamics. You could say that about a lot of personality things have nothing to do with throwing people around, right? Being on the set. Like, I've heard about Bruce Willis being a little tough to manage for younger directors. that would be interesting. I think Mark was talking about that for A Good Day to Die Hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, it's those interesting interactions between the people who play the characters. Or, you know, seeing how everyone reacts to Jared Leto, who's always methodly the Joker on set. Meanwhile, Will Smith is just Will Smith on the set of Suicide Squad.
No, I think I get what you're getting at. I think I get what you're trying to get at, Love and Good. Like, you just want to see these larger-than-life characters interact with each other.
Or Demi Moore or Elizabeth Berkley's boobs up close.
Right. Larger-than-life characters.
Yeah.
All right, so I think that's the answer. Elizabeth Berkley's boobs. That pool scene, it's kind of scarred in my brain.
Sex and Pools is not as comfortable as that movie makes it look.
Yeah. I don't think she was all that comfortable either.
I've had sex in pools with a couple people, and it's never actually been awesome for anything other than the fact that you then get to tell someone that you had sex in a pool.
Yeah, the chlorine just gets everywhere. All right. Back to the topic of the day. That's Star Trek. So we covered Star Trek in 2009 and Star Trek Into Darkness, the follow-up. The new movie, Star Trek Beyond, came out a couple weeks ago. And Love It Good, what are your first thoughts about Star Trek Beyond?
So, well, I just rewatched the first of the reboot Star Treks last night and today. Mm-hmm. Part two I haven't seen since it came out, but probably dwarfed, in my opinion, by 1 and 3. So part 1 gave us that great introduction, right? We were talking about that, the great reintroduction to these characters and how they fit in this universe. Well, for me, part 1 introduced us to the Federation, and these people were meeting each other. Star Trek Beyond showed us that they weren't just lived in like part 2, but there was a sense of family. These people needed to have close relationships based on the nature of their lives and their missions. And you had made reference, Lazbeth, to the 5-year mission, and in part 2, you're like, where's this mission? Yeah. Well, in this one, they open with, you know, we're on year 3 of a 5-year mission. Oddly enough, this is the 3rd movie. They're talking about how, you know, relationships organically start between cadets, if you will, and how these unlikely friendships will form, and how in a very, like, in a statement of humanity, it's kind of reflected on in the way, like, and we need that. Right. We need these interactions.
Yeah.
And so right away, like, I felt those first 20 minutes were nothing but warmth. Not like silly warm fuzzies, although there was a little of that. But to me, it's like the opening and closing scene of Love Actually. And the airports with the happiness and the sadness and the different reasons that we travel and the hugs and the hellos and goodbyes.
Yeah.
Like, sorry, Mark wasn't here to call that out. Call me out for the 5th time on Love Actually. But like those relationships, this movie showed the unity of this team in a different way than we had seen in the first 2 movies.
Right. So yeah, you definitely saw like the bond had gotten stronger between all the cast members. That was cool to see. And you also kind of got to see, like, you know, that the other side of that. Because sometimes, you know, familiarity can kind of breed a little bit of contempt. Or in this case, just a sense of complacency. Because the movie touches on Kirk just feeling a little lost. You know, he's on year 3 of his 5-year mission. He just feels like he just doesn't really know why he's in it anymore. There's like,
because he keeps doing it's like another mission and another mission and another.
He feels like it's just like he's going through the motions at this point. There's that great little scene he had with Bones where they were drinking Chekhov's whiskey.
That's right. We talked a lot about that back in what was that? The episode 69, Stranger Things episode.
Yeah, yeah.
We talked about the thievery of the Glenfiddich.
Yeah. But yeah, it was so it was definitely cool to see, like, you talked about, like, these characters felt like they were lived in. I'm like, yeah, you could definitely tell, like, you know, these characters, like, they're starting to kind of feel it. Like, they've been out in space, like, a long time. You know, they become very familiar with each other. And they're just kind of, like, they're starting to feel like a little bit of cabin fever setting in. And I think that's really cool to see, you know.
I mean, yeah, every now and then you'd probably get that feeling if you're on a mission like that. I'm assuming military personnel kind of feel that, especially Navy folks on, you know, if they're on a sub or, you know, what is it called? Like a battleship for months at a time. I imagine that that's not an unfamiliar feeling.
Right.
I wonder, like, this, how that makes you react to making new friendships. Are you recalcitrant about making new friendships, or do you jump at them kind of blindly?
Well, I imagine it's kind of hard to make friends in space. You know, it's just like, you know, maybe I can like make friends with some of the people on the ship, but I kind of hate most of these people. But at the same time, it's like, I just, what am I supposed to do? Like, what else has to go?
New friendships are just a crash landing and a distress beacon away.
Right. There you go. But, so yeah, you have Kirk kind of just feeling a little lost. Like, he's maybe thinking about leaving the Enterprise. You also have Spock also contemplating leaving the Enterprise, but for completely different reasons. You know, he finds out that Ambassador Spock died. In real life, Leonard Nimoy actually died before this movie came out, you know, tragically. So it was very touching to see kind of the movie's tribute to Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, so in this movie, their mission is not one of their typical exploration missions. They They get a distress call. We've already found out about the potential departure of Kirk or Spock, and they're keeping that to themselves. And they respond to this distress call. It's some alien woman without hair and this weird kind of cobra hood of a head. You know, I don't know how to describe her other than that. And they're going to rescue her ship and her crewmates who have been taken over by some other hostiles on this planet that's surrounded by a ring of space debris, you know, like a meteor ring that I guess confounds communication.
Right.
From ships, from starships to the planet.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So they go in and ultimately we find out we can't trust this woman. But on the way, I think we mentioned this in that episode a couple episodes back too, about how like the crew got separated and how different pairs of them were together. And so we saw new character dynamics between pairs of characters. Right. It was really great in the long run seeing Bones and Spock, right? Because Bones is the most... God.
He's the most human of all the humans.
He's the most logical from the point of self-preservation. Spock is the most logical from the point of the mission. But those two trains of logic do not necessarily serve the same means. The mission can put you at risk. Bones wants to be safe. So, like, that was a lot of fun, that interaction. And we had a Chekhov. Oh, who was Chekhov placed with?
Kirk.
With Kirk, right? And so Chekhov is very idiosyncratic. Kirk, really easy-go-lucky. And which way should we? This way. And he just goes, why that way? And he just goes. Like, it's,
yeah.
So there are a lot of interesting dynamics going on. On the way, they meet this new character who's kind of interesting. She's a little space ninja warriorette with some... did you notice that she had the fake eyelashes?
Did she?
Oh, yeah. Like a runway model. She had long fake eyelashes.
You know what's weird about her character is that, like, her character design is that she had, like, these kind of black streaks running down her face. It kind of made me think, like, her mascara is running, like, the whole
right.
time. I'm just like...
Like she was sad that she was alone.
Yeah, that's what it looked like. It looked like she'd been crying and her mascara is just running. I'm like, oh.
She was a neat character, a very sincere character that
very
played in
resourceful character, for sure.
Irregularly resourceful, yeah. She accomplished a lot more than I think you would expect a whole crew to even do. And, I don't know. So we eventually meet our bad guys, right? And I'm going to say this about the whole reboot series, is that their bad guys in the third acts are not good at being bad guys.
Yeah.
Again, I never found Banna convincing. I had mentioned that in the first hour of part two, Khan was a great villain. I kind of specified that because after that, it was kind of dodgy for me, the convincingness of him as a villain. Mm-hmm. And then in part three, so this was Idris Elba, right?
Which I had no idea that he was in the movie. Good research
right.
on my part.
I only knew it from Facebook before I saw it.
Right.
So they have this weird, like, energy transfer that lets them live for an extra 100 years.
So they yada-yadded it, but, like, it was really funny the way they yada-yadded it. Like, it just showed, like, the bad guy crawl, just, like, grab some wires and just start, like, convulsing next to, like, these two humans that were tied up. I'm like, oh, I guess that's what he does.
And he stole their life.
Sure.
Like a space vampire.
I mean, they never explained it, obviously.
And then for some reason later in the movie, when he sucks the life out of some other people, he finally looks like Idris Elba.
Kinda. It's just like, yeah, they definitely yada-yada that,
like,
really hard.
I'm so, like, I hated all that. I thought, in this movie, I just thought the bad guys sucked, and I never liked them from the start. Once there was the ambush, I didn't like that. Now, I like this movie a lot. I'm just, for whatever reason, I can say that the whole bad guy dynamic didn't work for me, And I still like the movie.
I just felt like the motivation for Crawl and his bad guys, it was flimsy at best. So you find out near the end of the movie that the that Crawl and his men were actually stranded crew members of the USS Franklin.
From 100 years ago.
Yeah, they were stranded on this planet. They, I guess, find alien technology that extends their lives. But in the process, it kind of, you know, disfigured them and turned them to, like, really alien-like, you know, figures. And it's just like, I guess, you know, they're pissed off at Starfleet, you know, for sending them out here. And it's just like, so because of that, Crawl wants to just blow up the Yorktown space station. It's just like, okay, like it just doesn't.
Which is basically like a Death Star of good intentions,
right?
Like it's this huge, almost planet-like colony of people, and he wants to deliver this weird alien technology there that does the exact opposite of what it does for him. Yeah. It just destroys all life, and he's got to put it basically in the air vent, if you will, the air filtration of the whole place. And by the way, John,
yes.
Let's just say, well, so he always planned on doing this. He always planned on doing this, on delivering this, you know, this weird biogenic alien weapon,
yeah,
to corrupt all of this station, this huge planet-like colony, right?
Yeah.
So if he never went to war with the Enterprise, if he just flew on over, mm-hmm, and came in as some weird foreign race somehow, snuck in somehow. I'm sure with all his resources, he could sneak in somehow with a lot of patience, right?
Yeah.
Well, then no one would be looking for him when he went to the air filtration thing to go deliver. And he could have just done it.
Yeah, and by the time they figured out something was wrong, like he would have already been up in there.
Would have already done it.
Yeah.
Like this is one of the, this is more Yada. They blood sported this.
Listen, they just needed, like, a reason for Kirk and Crawl to be in that really cool set piece in the climax of the movie.
Like, it was that zero-gravity nonsense fight.
Yeah, where, like, the gravity got all screwy, and they were, like, getting to the, to jump into the gravity slipstream and, like, all that. It was cool to watch. You know, it was a cool little fight scene, I gotta admit. It didn't make a lick of sense, but, you know, it was entertaining.
Speaking of not making sense, I just have to come back to this. So Spock keeps using the word logical, mm-hmm, and almost all the time that he uses the word logical, I almost feel like it's like when a professor is talking to a student, and the student says, oh, but what about this, that, or the other? And he says, no, I'm the professor.
Yeah.
It's not logical. Like, because I don't agree that these things that Spock says are logical are logical. I don't. There is a logic, but he's trying to say it like it's unequivocally, this is the most logical thing. And that doesn't make sense to me. In part one, when Spock's dad said, I was an ambassador to Earth, marrying your human mother was logical. I was there to observe human behavior, so marrying a human was logical. That's a decision.
Yeah,
that doesn't necessarily. You could have just gotten a roommate, buddy, and shared some beers and listened to podcasts together. And like, I don't agree with the logic of these movies.
you're putting too much thought into these movies, Levin.
But theoretically speaking, the Vulcans are putting too much thought into it and then misusing the word logical.
Stop pulling at the threads, Levin. Good. You're just gonna unravel it all.
Let me tell you something I did like, that if you told me about this movie and I didn't see it before, I would have thought would be the stupidest thing ever.
Really?
The fact that in two movies of this three-movie reboot, they used the Beastie Boys song Sabotage.
It's a good song. I mean, it's catchy. It was a pleasant surprise, you know, when they started busting out that song. If for those of you who have kind of recap, I'm hoping you've seen this movie already, because otherwise we spoiled the hell out of it for you. But like, so, you know, at one point in the movie, they had to kind of disorient the swarm of the enemies, like, because there was like a bunch of smaller ships. It was like a swarm of bees, and like they figured out like one way to disrupt communications between all the ships is just blast like really loud music.
They Independence Day'd it.
Yeah, yeah. So they just booted up like the music that just happened to be on the hard drive of the Franklin. Apparently, it was just a lot of Public Enemy and Beastie Boys. So
yeah, I like getting the Public Enemy in there.
Yeah, but yeah, that was an interesting little scene. It was it was definitely like a very summer action movie moment. They're just flying around like blaring Beastie Boys.
You see, I'll bet a lot of people rolled their eyes at that, but I did remember that Sabotage was in Part One. And then, and I didn't remember why, but I just remembered that it was somehow in it. And then when I just rewatched Part One over last night and today, before we did the podcast, and I saw it, it was back when Kirk is a kid. It was when Kirk was like 10 years old, and arguably speaking, Sabotage wasn't super, super old. And so, like, it connected to Kirk's playing that song when he stole, like, his stepdad's car.
Right.
So, that was, I mean, it was kind of cool. If you didn't know that, then you'd just be like, Beastie Boys song? Whatever, J.J. Abrams, or whoever directed this one.
Actually, it was like, Justin Lin. Justin Lin
directed. Oh, that's right, Justin Lin. Yeah. But it's like, you'd just be like, whatever. Like, but that was a nice, it was a nice little, like, flavor particle that connected it to Part One.
What did you think about the other kind of connection to Part One, where he was just driving around on that old motorcycle, just drawing the gunfire of the enemies? that was just a great little summer action movie scene.
Okay, let me just say that my opinion is that Justin Lin is really good at sweeping shots of worlds. Mm-hmm. And not very good at action sequences. And I say the same thing for Furious 6, or Fast and Furious 6. I wasn't convinced by any of the action in Fast and Furious 6.
Yeah.
I for my taste, I don't like his sense of action. But I love his sweeping camera shots. Like, think Avatar. You know how, like, we'll call it the virtual camera is panning around when you're seeing the world in Avatar, and when you're getting the bird's eye view of when he's on that bird creature.
Yeah.
Flying around. Those kinds of shots, Justin Lin, fantastic. Both movies, in fact. Hmm. But for the actual action, the high-intensity action, the shooting, the driving, I'm not a fan. I hope he never does a martial arts movie ever. I think he'd ruin the hell out of it.
There'd be great sweeping camera shots, though.
Right, it would be like, oh, the world, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the action, 1980s Jeff Speakman.
So, I definitely enjoyed this movie more than the second. It definitely doesn't hit the same highs as the first one did. Do you agree or no?
I agree, but I will say that the different kind of high, that warm, fuzzy family sense of high, especially in the first act, was itself. It wasn't as big, but it was very powerful. Like, it was so noteworthy to me that the only reason that I'm saying that it's less than Part One is because Part One was so spectacular to me.
Yeah. So Part One, you know, clearly the best, 95% Rotten Tomatoes. Inner Darkness, 86%. And Star Trek Beyond is very similar, around 83%. So
I think that's also because it's new. Mm. And even though fanboys are fanboys, a lot of these people, they wait until they can get stuff pirated, or they wait until they can see it for cheaper.
Yeah. So what do you think the filmmakers can do for the next Star Trek movie to kind of recapture the magic of the first one, if it's possible?
Well, you know, I think that a good hedge point is always Spock and Kirk.
Yes.
First one was mostly conflict, finding peace. Second one lived in, we're very used to each other. There are just a few cheeky-isms. In this third one, they had their own internal conflicts and they both chose greater goods and saw that in each other at the end. Like, I feel like now they can behave like friends. They've just reached that point, in my opinion,
right,
where they can behave as equals, not in a professional capacity, but just as I view as my equal. So I think that just what they do with the relationships can keep them, these movies working. For plot points, well, now it's been too long. I hope they don't bring Khan back.
Yeah.
Like they left that open, right? I hope it doesn't involve whales or losing Spock.
No.
I don't need whales controlling the universe any more than I need a dolphin telling me that 7 times 7 is 42. Like, I just don't need these things. I don't know, man. But here's the thing. I hope nobody predicts it. I really hope that they manage to nail something original. First movie was original, but it's because they were just showing us these characters in a way we never saw them, finding their roles, right?
Yeah.
Second one, they just did a different take on Khan.
Mm-hmm.
Third one, boy, you know, I really didn't care about the plot.
No, I don't think anybody did.
I love the movie, but I thought the plot sucked.
Yeah.
So I just hope they come up with a good original plot, period. Just give me a capable plot and throw in these great lived-in characters with these great actors, and I think it could be spectacular. Just give me a half-decent plot.
All right. So here are my wishes for a future Star Trek movies. I agree with your first point, Living Good. Everything hinges on the relationship between Kirk and Spock. It's really what the whole series is kind of based on. It's just so Star Trek Beyond, if you think about it, there weren't actually a lot of scenes, you know, between Kirk and Spock because they were separated. I mean, that's fine, but you didn't really get the that really awesome dynamic that you should that you got to see in the first movie, you know.
Yeah, we just had their parallel conflicts with the Federation.
Yeah, so in a future movie, I want to see more Kirk and Spock, or specifically Kirk and Spock together. Like, I want to see what other facets of their relationship can be explored. Like, that would be really cool. The second thing is that, you know, maybe this might be asking for too much because it's really kind of a action movie franchise at this point. But it'd be really cool to take, like, a really hard kind of sci-fi plot. You know, like, in a TV series, like, there were some episodes. My favorite episodes were the ones where it's just, like, it was, like, there wasn't, like, a lot of action. It was just, like, a lot of really cool, far-out, like, sci-fi stuff. Like, maybe, like, they got caught in a time loop or something like that. I mean, that's not original.
Actually give us some storytelling.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be cool. Like, you know, maybe, like, a time loop wouldn't be, like, original. But it'd be different. Like, I feel like Star Trek, you get more room to experiment as opposed to something like Star Wars where, you know, people are expecting, like, certain things to be in the movie. So I think if they just, like, you know, experiment, like, maybe incorporate more sci-fi elements into the plot, I think that would be perfect, you know. And also, I want to see Alice Eve come back. What happened to her character?
Like, I agree. Fine actress. I'd love to see her on screen again.
Okay, so the first movie, you had that green alien chick. The second movie, you had Alice Eve. The third movie, you didn't really have anybody, right? It was just like there's no kind of weird alien eye candy to look at.
I mean, that I can't think of her name, but our main alien friendly on that hostile planet.
Oh, she was never meant to be like a...
Whatever, she's cute.
I guess. I don't know.
She's cute. I mean, just because you don't see her in her underwear.
I've seen sexier aliens. That's all I'm
in saying. In their underwear. Right. Because they were in their underwear.
Okay. If I saw her in her underwear, maybe. But I never saw her in underwear, so.
You just got to work on the set of striptease.
Okay. So that's my wish. Kirk and Spock. More sci-fi stuff. And more alien TNA. I think that's the... That's the secret formula for a successful Star Trek movie.
I mean, I'm on board with all those things.
Sure. I feel like they haven't really, you know, mentioned how many movies they're going to make in the reboot timeline, have they?
Well, I don't know. With the age of these characters, even if they wait like a solid 3-4 years between movies, they could easily do 6 or 7.
Yeah, because the TV series, like they were, well, no, not TV series, but the original movies, they were definitely of an older age. So
yeah, I mean, so we're at part 3, right? And it's 2016. So let's just say they did a 4 in 2019. If they did every 3 years, a 5 in 22, a 6 in 25, a 7 in 2028. That's just 12 years from now to get to a part 7 if they do 3 years.
Yeah.
So, and if they did 4 years, every 4 years, it would just be, what was I saying? Like 12 years. It would just be 16 years from now. They wouldn't even be, would they be 50 maybe? I mean, that's fine. That's the.
How old was Shatner, you know, when
well,
he was.
Shatner was an easy 50, but he was also a 50 back when 50 looked 50. Yeah. Our 50 does not look like 50 of that time period.
Isn't Brad Pitt like 50 these days?
Exactly.
He looks like he's in his early 40s, late 30s.
If Brad Pitt just shaved his beard and used some Just for Men, like, he would look younger than 35-year-old Bill Shatner. Like, I mean, he'd be like day one on the set Bill Shatner.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, so... But again, we have action stars who are being action stars when they're older now. People in their 70s, like Arnold and Sly in the last Expendables movies, or in Expendables 2, I think they were like in their early 60s in Expendables 2. Those dudes are in their early 60s. Do you realize that hair dye or not? Like just their faces, and sure, they've gotten a little work maybe, but those guys look like people did 10, 15 years younger than them.
Oh, yeah.
If you go back to the 80s.
Yeah.
Most actors do now, I feel like. We're all healthier, even our generation versus our parents. When I used to think of 35 when I was a kid, I thought that was middle-aged.
Yeah.
I would not have thought, if you asked me when I was 15 years old, hey, 15-year-old John, do you think 35-year-old John would be able to squat 500 pounds? I'd be like, you're nuts.
No way.
Guess what? 35-year-old John does that.
You thought you'd be in a walker by now.
I'm very gray, but if I shave, I don't look nearly as old.
Yeah.
With my beard, I look like Tommy Lee Jones when they found him in Portland, Oregon in the beginning of The Hunted.
Wow.
I feel like I look like I'm 50.
But yeah, so... You know, so far, the reboot trilogy movies, it's a trilogy at the moment. It's going good so far. Like, I've enjoyed all the movies. I hope they keep making more. I don't feel burnt out at the moment. Like, I'm not at Star Trek's Nemesis levels of burnt out right
what
now.
What other series of movies had 3 consecutive movies that you thought were great? Now... Some people think I'm nuts, but I would actually say the Matrix movies. A lot of people say, oh, part 2 sucked. No, I loved all 3 of the Matrix movies, but they were 99 to 2004. That's a generation ago at this point.
Okay. I'm thinking...
Lord of the Rings movies, maybe? Some serious epics? There's not a lot of trios of movies.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings. I really enjoyed the Indiana Jones trilogy. You know, a lot of people hate Temple of Doom, but I love Temple of Doom.
Right. They ended in 93 or so.
Yeah.
So that's way back. Like, there aren't a lot of good trios.
Sure, sure. So, yeah, this Star Trek reboot trilogy, I think it's done good. So, which is
I mean, hell, I didn't even like Thor 2. I loved Thor 1. I thought Thor 2 was weak. Yeah, like, there's already an example of things falling apart. You know what? Captain America.
Wait, no. Really? You like the first Captain America?
Yeah, it wasn't as good as the others, but the character building was so amazing to me.
I don't know. I mean,
the bad guy was non-existent. Red Skull may as well have not existed in that movie for me.
I don't know. I thought it was a little bit too corny for my taste.
I liked it. Yeah. It was like the 50s. 50s. Do you have any idea like what life was like in the 50s? I think that's that was a good depiction.
I know. I don't know what life was like in the 50s. I missed out on that.
Or the 40s.
Sure. All right. So, yeah. Final verdict for the Star Trek reboot so far for you, Loving Good. Good.
I'm super thrilled, and I am in no way fearful of any number of sequels.
Yeah. I wouldn't bother me if they just made like an indefinite amount.
Please, make 8 of them. That's great.
I love the characters. I think the actors they cast are brilliantly, cast. They do a great job. Maybe Zachary Quinto can one day achieve the gravitas of Leonard Nimoy. We'll see. He's still young.
Leonard Nimoy had a lot more time on screen to build that gravitas.
Sure. Sure.
Like if you go all the way back to the beginning of Leonard Nimoy on Star Trek, mm-hmm. It's not like he was mind blowing.
Yeah. Yeah. The early years, like the first couple seasons of the original series, he was definitely not, older Nimoy.
You just said the first couple seasons. There only were a couple seasons. There was like one season and like a fraction of a season, I think.
Well, I think there were like 3 seasons, right?
No. Nah.
I think we might have to argue about this after the podcast. But before we sign off, are there any plugs you want to make?
Well, not Red Bull or Domino's because we're not eating any sponsor-provided pizza and drink and washing it down with any sponsor-provided flavored energy drinks.
Yeah, what's going on, guys?
I mean, I'm assuming they're listening.
Yeah, yeah. let's see. So what? The Lamb? The large ass movie blog or no, the large association.
Large Association of Movie Blogs.
I'd rather say large ass movie blog.
I like large ass. It sounds better. I mean there's that shark dropper gaggle of podcasters that you kind of canoodle with.
Sure, sure.
You guys have like 86 different podcasts, and this is just one of them.
Yeah, yeah. I think movies, films, and flicks, right?
Oh, that's a thing. I think people are listening to it.
It's the namesake of this podcast.
We've got a website, too.
Yeah. Let's see, what else? Check out Mark Hoffmeyer's CIA blog. I think
that's
it's
right.
on...
it's the backdoors of the internet.com.
Yeah. Just remember, if he tells you he's in Albania, he's probably
in Chechnya.
Yeah. Can't trust him. Can't trust him. All right. I think that does it for all the plugs. I think that does it. Right, Loving Good?
Yeah, I mean, outside of some kind of gratuitous Kurt Russell reference.
There you go. From my co-host, John Loving Good.
Hi, folks.
I'm your host, John Lawson. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you guys next time.
Minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.